Before we start the show, we heard from some of you a couple of weeks ago that you'd suddenly gotten, like, the entire 300-episode archive of the podcast downloading, and we do know why that happened. We've been doing some work on the podcast delivery system here at NPR, and the good news is that this should mean some improvements to the way that our podcasts work. The less good news is that it required everything essentially to be republished under the new system, so if you had your podcast feeds set up to download all episodes, it downloaded all the episodes. We temporarily trimmed the archive back to only a few shows to stop that from happening long enough for us to give you a heads up. So here it is. It's a good time to check your podcast feed settings on your player or your phone or on your tablet, whether you use iTunes or Android or something else, and consider putting a limit on how many episodes of any given show get downloaded at once. You'll probably find over time that it will help keep your feeds a little cleaner. It'll keep you from getting a great big download you weren't expecting when we do reestablish that whole archive, which is going to happen soon, or when we or anybody else is working on our systems. So thank you for listening, thank you for downloading, and let's do a show. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Give the Latino USA podcast from NPR a listen. Latino USA covers current and emerging issues impacting Latinos and other people of color. Reporting on how people live with, struggle with, and celebrate difference, Latino USA chronicles how Latinos are living, shaping, and changing America. Find Latino USA now at iTunes.com/NPR. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll talk about Fox's empire, the furs, the music, and the fact that Cookie is out. Then we'll follow up on a recent conversation about the variety of voices you hear on the radio. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, with us this week is our pal Tanya Ballard Brown. Tanya, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor for our website and aspiring mischief maker.
Oh, wonderful. And with us also is our other pal, Gene Demby. Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch.
Well, one of the reasons why we have Gene and Tanya here is that they are two of our favorite Empire tweeters to differing degrees and in different ways. Now, I should say first, the show is about a hip-hop mogul named Lucius Lyon, who's played by Terrence Howard, who has three sons, who I would call the business one, the gay one, and the wild one. Mm-hmm. And he wants one of them to take over his entertainment empire, which is called Empire Entertainment. This is all complicated by the fact that Lucius's ex-wife and the boy's mother, Cookie, has just gotten out of jail after serving a long prison sentence. How long did you say it was, Tanya?
17 years, honey.
To protect Lucius from the consequences of the drug business that they both ran that funded the early days of the company. Do I have that down?
I think so. I think so, yeah.
Also, Lucius has ALS and he's dying.
I totally forgot he's dying. That is not to make light of his illness or anyone's illness, but this show has a lot going on. For example, I forgot that the main character is dying. And there is also in this show lots of sex and murder and, oh my goodness, if it happens in the world or doesn't happen in the world, it happens on this show. So, Tanya, what has been your reaction to this first handful of Empire episodes?
I'm reserving judgment. I'm going to continue watching because one thing Scandal has taught me is that there doesn't have to be a character I like on a show. And there isn't a character I like on Empire currently. There could be one. I mean, I think I'm supposed to like Jamal, but I need Jamal to, you know, like...
He's the gay one.
Yes. Yes.
Do you feel like they've established who that guy is besides the fact that he's the gay one? I feel like they've relied on that pretty heavily.
And that he's a good piano player, singer, and he's the middle son.
He's gay and magnanimous. That is.
There you go. Gay and magnanimous.
And there's been a little bit of a hint recently that now he's kind of going to go to war with his father. But it's like he hasn't seemed like the type up until now. He's seemed kind of, I don't know. Glenn, what are you thinking about Empire?
Linda Holmes, this is how you do it. This is what this is what Boy Next Door so wanted to be and failed.
Oh, stop.
This is how you, if you have an inherent cheesiness, what you do is you double down on that cheesiness until it becomes positively arteriosclerotic. sclerotic. You need to take some Lipitor before you see this show. Every word of dialogue, every moment, every scene, every episode is underlined and italicized and bold-faced and highlighted in yellow and in 28-point type and in wingdings with a red circle around it. You could be in a light but persistent vegetative state and still get everything that's going on in this show.
But didn't Shonda prove that, it's that true. People watch it?
That's exactly
right. I think
right.
It's very scandal-inspired.
Somebody says a thing, and then it is shown, and then it's said again. Yeah. The very first thing the gay character says is, a lot of homophobia in the black community.
Yes. The greatest line ever.
And then we get his father, flashback to a party scene where that same kid is a very young boy, sashays into a scene in high heels with a wrap around his head. And his father, you'll remember that there's some homophobia in the black community. His father picks him up and puts him in the garbage.
That's true.
Now, Lee Daniels said that really happened to him.
So I'm just saying there is no restraint. This is not about show, don't tell. Also, the main thing I love about this show is that Cookie's out.
Ladies and gentlemen, the queen has returned. So when did you get out?
2 days ago. You really,
It was your sacrifice that made a lot of this possible. I can't imagine what you've been through, Cookie.
You still owe me what's mine.
What are you talking about?
Half of this company. It was my $400,000 that started this bitch. You know it and I know it. These 17 hard years for that money. And I want half my company back.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. 17 years, and she brought all her leopard print, animal print clothes with her.
She has an actual, not only does she have a purple fur stole, but she has a leopard print. It looks like a fur leopard print fedora.
Yes.
That is insane in
because
a great way.
As Lovey would say, you can't outdo black people. That's what.
Yeah. Well, Gene, you and I talked early in the history of this show about how certain, you know, Tanya mentioned Lee Daniels, who did Precious and The Butler and is responsible for this show.
Responsible.
Who, you know, has talked about the fact that some of this is, you know, based on things that he's seen happen. But we both had the feeling that, like, some of the dialogue seems like it was run through a kind of hip-hop dialogue generating machine.
If you'd watched any conversation about hip-hop, like, in 1992, like,
this
that,
is it.
The
yeah.
conversations that they have on the show about, like corporate America is not ready for hip-hop. And it's like, what? Like,
corporate America loves
somebody
hip-hop.
Needs to tell Jay-Z.
I mean, it feels like so many of the there was in one of the most recent episodes, there's a sit-down interview in which this lady's grilling him about the fact that his music is really irresponsible and violent.
You're
and
encouraging violence.
It felt like the conversations around, like, N.W.A., or Two Live Crew,
right.
Or, yeah. I mean, it felt like 25 years old. And even, like, the idea of, like, this super powerful record company executive is, like, sort of laughable now, right? I mean, it's 2015. People don't sell a ton of records. I mean, yeah. He's like, I want to have the number one song on the charts. So like,
which chart?
Yeah, what does that what does that mean?
Yeah.
It just sort of exists in this, like, out of place and time. Like,
yeah, and I think there was a big thing about, like, we're going to make a music video, which I know they make videos, but I got the sense that it was a little bit disproportionate as far as its importance, whereas you don't really hear a lot on this show about the kind of whole digital music business, it doesn't seem like. It seems like, as Gene was saying, it's very much a spinning singles-oriented vision of the record industry.
And it's odd because you would expect that from Cookie. She, you know, Cookie was gone for 17 years.
Right, so she comes back. She's so like, where's all the LPs? Yeah.
Right, you know, she's asking about CD, you know, whatever. But if Lucius is running an empire, you would think that he would be more cutting edge and be, yeah. You know, so.
Let's talk for a moment about Cookie, played by the fabulous Taraji P. Henson.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone has come to appreciate, despite how silly this show is,
yes.
She is selling it.
Yep.
Yes.
I mean,
she
yes.
is, everything.
She showed up in the premiere episode with these hoop earrings the size of dinner plates. The new woman and Cookie and
Boo
Lucius.
Boo Kitty.
Boo
yeah,
Boo Kitty.
Boo Kitty, yes. Boo Boo Kitty.
She calls her Boo Boo Kitty. They have this confrontation. And one of the things I liked about it is that Boo Boo Kitty, although she is no Cookie, it is safe to say Boo Boo Kitty is no Cookie.
But she can
and
dish
that,
it. She
that is
dish.
How you know you're watching Empire. But she's not a like a the nice kind sure. of young, innocent. And Cookie comes in and says, hey, no, I'm going to tell you how things are. And Boo Boo Kitty says, okay, and acts like Boo Boo Kitty.
Right.
Boo Boo Kitty's like, I'm going to cut you. Because that's how everyone talks on this
Absolutely
show.
Right.
Everyone on this show will cut you, apparently.
I don't know that Boo Boo Kitty is as tough as she thinks she is. Because she's at, was it a drive-by shooting? And she's at the table where the bullets will say, oh, Lord, they're shooting. Yes, yes. Everyone else is on the floor. You're staring out of the window.
Boo Boo Kitty failed to take cover. That's true.
Now, Lee Daniels, bless his hammy fists, is a co-creator of this show with Danny Strong. Now, Danny Strong comes to the table with some serious nerd cred. He played Jonathan on Buffy, had a featured role in Gilmore Girls. He's since become a screenwriter, a writer for HBO films like Recount and Game Change. Now, those are not necessarily scripts you need a lot of character nuance for. What you need is distill this huge thing that happened into something that is clear. Mm-hmm. So you pair him with Lee Daniels, whose lack of subtlety, when it is paired with something noble and well-intentioned and good, tends to get very cloying and manipulative.
The butler.
But turns out, when you pair it with something as soapy and excessive as this, you get, we can debate whether or not it's camp, it's certainly funny.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Funny.
Yeah, it's so dialed up, but in a very different way from Jane the Virgin, which we talked about last week, but a kind of parallel way. What I respect about Empire is that it knows exactly what show it is.
Exactly.
Yes. Very much the same way you can turn on Jane the Virgin at any time and you can say, they know exactly what they want this show to feel like. And when I watch Empire, whether you're kind of watching Terrence Howard, who seems to think that he's emoting, or you're watching Taraji P. Henson, who seems to think she's doing both. She's emoting, but she's also just, you know, making it as big as possible. Mm-hmm. They have an established feeling for how they want this show to be, and I think they're pretty good at making the show feel that way. You know, there's some credibility. Timbaland is producing the music, and the music that they use as the music that is being created by all these people is credible to me. Mm-hmm. I don't like all of it, but it's absolutely credible music to me. And I realized today that while I was watching one episode and there was a song that started that was supposed to not be a very good song, despite the fact that it was being done competently, I thought, I think that's not a very good song. And then it wasn't in the story. And I thought, I am following what they're doing musically in this show. It is an accomplishment to be able to say your show is about music, and the music is credible. I think
some other things that I noticed about this show, they're focused on some stereotypes, but they avoided some others, like Cookie and Lucius were married.
Yeah.
And had three kids.
No, that's a great point.
But they were drug hustlers.
No, it's not.
I don't I don't claim to come from Morrissey Project. You know, I wasn't on the corner down in the trap. You know, I was in North Carolina marching in the band. But they could have hung this on, like, baby mama, you know, kind of drama. He divorced her while she was in prison.
Yeah.
And that was why she had the claim to the record company, right? Was it because they were married and they were...
That and... She, you know, has said several times now that it was her $400,000 that started this company. So half of it is man.
It's true. No, it's true. And I think you're right. And I think, as you said, they're drug hustlers, but it's a family story.
Sure.
And it's clear that part of the reason why they have this conflict is their feelings about how to raise their kids and how to deal with their boys that they... You know, raised together, and then she went away, and the youngest one clearly didn't spend a lot of time with her, and it's kind of estranged
from her. I'm curious, though, like, who helped Lucius become this scarf-wearing... I mean, you know, I guess he took this bandana off his head and wrapped it around his neck, but, like, who helped him become this Black Hugh Hefner?
Because
he was that, you know?
Fantastic question. I was watching it yesterday.
Because you don't just,
He was supposed to be, like, he's, like, I'm the king of the streets, and then, like, you see him now, he's, like, velvet... Blazers and like ascots.
Scarf. He has a different scarf. Watch the scarf.
That is not a natural transition for anyone.
No. That's a great
So I'm like, who was his god? Is it because to me it seems that he had to make it earlier versus later because his kids are really polished,
right? Yeah, he grew up rich. And,
the son with the Whartons. Yeah. I mean, and that's actually one of we joked about the business son, gay son, and rapper son. But one of the things that's fascinating about the show to me is even the ancillary women are like much more sort of like colorful than the three sons are.
Yeah,
like,
right.
I mean, Naomi Campbell shows up and she's like much more interesting to watch than the rapper dude. The rapper dude is so uninteresting. But like,
and again, talk about 1992. That rapper son really seems to me like.
With his, what is it? Special ed.
Yeah.
I got it made.
Cuts in the side. Yeah. But like the I'm gonna call her White Wife. I don't know her name. White Wife.
White Wife of Business Son.
She's sort of like this Lady Macbeth figure. Even like a Portia, Cookie's assistant, is like gets like some one-liners in.
Yeah.
But like the sons, they are like uninterested.
I'd extend that to Terrence Howard's character. Or maybe it's their performance, but he's just sort of sitting there and he's not giving you much. Well, of course, you know, he's standing next to Cookie.
In those early episodes, I do think there is an issue with the fact that her presence is so big that it makes everybody seem super boring.
Even the jokes to me that I remember of his that were funny, the lines was the one where it's still Cookie related. Like when his son came in, he was like, oh, I see you met your mama, you know.
Yeah.
After she beat him with,
with the broom or whatever.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, which shouldn't be funny, but.
It's one of those shows where things that shouldn't be funny, like wind up seeming funny. Like all these crazy family stories and all that stuff.
So do you guys think that Cookie will eventually like swallow the show whole? Like, do you think she'll actually be?
It's a risk.
It is a risk. I mean, I think part of the problem is they've set her up as this antagonist, right? Mm-hmm. She comes in, she's like, I'm going to take the company. Like Tanya said, the $400,000 was mine and it's half my company. And so the question is, like, how long can she stay at that level of tension with Lucius? Mm-hmm. And at what point do they have to then either get back together or, I mean, I think clearly you're going to see a situation where he is cheating on Boo Boo Kitty with Cookie. I don't have any question that that's going to go on down the line.
That's
going to be their sweeps, whatever.
I suggested, you know, on my tweets that Puffy come on and be a love interest for Taraji.
Or
maybe Tyrese, you know, they could revive baby boy grown folk version.
Well, they gave her a Cuba Gooding
Jr. They gave her Cuba Gooding Jr. entry level guest star. And yeah. They're going to go from there.
Cuba Gooding Jr. and Terrence Howard in the same. I was like, we are a Method Man appearance away from this being Red Tails. I will turn it off right now. I see what you're doing.
Gene and Red Tails. It's never far from the surface. It's hugely popular and it's been growing week to week. Essentially is the thing that never happens. But the other shows that that happens with are Shonda Rhimes shows. Mm-hmm. So it's like all of a sudden network television is having this moment of being like, oh, you know, who
other
still,
people watch TV.
You know who still watches the TV?
Right.
The blah people.
The blah.
And so it is interesting to kind of ponder.
I think when you look at the numbers, I think black women watch more TV per week than any other sort of cohort. I still watch Scandal religiously. I have a Scandal party every Thursday. And a lot of that is just social momentum. Like, it's just like, it is fun to sit down and live tweet this with other people.
Because I hate watch it, but I watch it.
Exactly.
I still have to sit down and watch it.
I mean, it is so much fun to watch it that way. And even if I didn't like Empire, it's like, it is a very fun show. Even if it went like off the rails, it would be fun to watch it with people and sit in the theater and yell at the screen with everybody. You know?
However bad it's going to go, it's probably going to go there in a fun way.
Yeah. But it is amazing how much momentum it has.
And it's timing, it's cold, it's weather.
Well, there are a couple of models for it, right? Mm-hmm. One of which is Scandal, which we've talked about. Mm-hmm. I think it has a lot in common with Scandal. But I also think it has a ton in common with Nashville.
Yeah.
When I first saw it, my first thought is hip-hop Nashville.
Right, yeah.
When I watched Nashville, it was the same way. I was like, I don't want to hear about people trying to sign their record deal. Mm-hmm. I want to see the people argue. It's kind of the same thing.
No, it reminds me of Dynasty. It reminds me of RuPaul's Drag Race.
The bigness of the personalities probably supports that. Well, my guess is based on pure numbers that quite a number of you who are listening watch Empire or have watched Empire. So I would be fascinated to hear what you think. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/monkeysee. And, you know, tell us what you think. Empire, you liking? Are you still keeping up? Is there something that we've missed about the Suns that they are more interesting than we think they are? So the other thing we were going to talk about this week, Gene has done a lot of work on this already. Mm-hmm. There was an essay that came out. I first saw it on Transom and tweeted it when it was on Transom, which is a terrific site that has a lot of content about radio and doing radio. It was an essay by Chenjerai Kumanyika about being a black guy trying to get into radio and trying out his voice in different ways and trying out his hearing himself kind of try to sound like a radio person, I guess, is what I took from it. And then this essay moved from Transom to BuzzFeed, and then there was a conversation that happened on NPR. Gene, you and Audie Cornish, our pal Audie Cornish, who we love, did some of the work on this Twitter conversation about this. Can you talk a little bit about how that went?
So within 5 minutes, so Audie Cornish is to my left and Sam Sanders, who was one of our reporters, is FaceTiming in and we're just sort of talking. Within 5 minutes, it's like drinking from a fire hydrant. It's like, there's so many tweets coming in. I don't think we could have possibly anticipated, yeah. Which Twitter is a very specific place where it's young, it's brown, and the people who follow us, I mean, there's probably a lot of overlap there. Right.
What were people saying to you?
A lot of people sort of said, like, there's a range of sort of registers that people speak in and they can't, that you don't hear on NPR. I mean, it's not just like black people's voices. To the extent that NPR has a whiteness associated with it, it's like you don't hear Southern accents, you don't hear Baltimore accents, you don't hear South Philly accents.
You don't even hear Upper Midwest accents.
Absolutely, right.
I mean, one of the things that I had said while you were having that conversation is that I think there's an idea that ideally you take your own voice out of it. And there were a bunch of reporters who made the point, it's not supposed to be about you. Sure. It's supposed to be about the story. So you kind of want your voice to be invisible, I think is the way that a lot of people interpret it. But then the question becomes, what is an invisible voice?
Right, absolutely.
Like, what is a kind of neutral, says nothing about you voice?
Absolutely.
If we say that if you have a Baltimore accent, it says something about you, then not having a Baltimore accent says something about you too.
When I saw the piece, I was like, oh, for two reasons. One, the first time I did something on air and I shared it with a friend, he said, do they train all of y'all to talk like that NPR? Because this doesn't sound like you. And I thought, wow. And the second reason it resonated with me is because when I come here to join you guys, uh-huh. I always think, oh, I need to enunciate.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
And speak very well and make my mother proud. Uh-huh. And then as I get involved with the conversation, I go, well, I'm North Carolina. I get more comfortable and I forget that. And right. So I don't often listen to these podcasts because then I hear that I've dropped the G's and I've, you know,
my mama wouldn't like it. It's not the same thing, but so do I. I mean, I think let me be the person to go up and hug the elephant in the room, which is that we started this show with four white people who are of a similar age. And that for us, working on trying to incorporate a lot of people into the show is something that I think we do more of than we used to. I think we do better than we used to. But it is something that we still work on because the circumstances, and this is related to a conversation that I saw Gene having with a bunch of, I think, your friends from like Post Bougie and some of your other folks, that you tend to start projects, especially projects that aren't anything yet, right, with people that you know.
Right.
And so Stephen and I were best friends, and Trey Graham, who was an original part of this project, was my editor at NPR, and we knew Glenn, and we were asking people to do something that was on everyone's own time. Sure. And so it reinforces the fact that you tend to deal with people that you already know,
sure.
And that lowers your likelihood that you're going to get a mix of people. Right. So it's something that we have since then worked on and thought about a lot. I love having people on the show who have a variety of voices, not just what Tanya's talking about North Carolina, but when Jess Gittner used to produce this show and would come on and talk about like her love of movies that were really important to her as like a young lesbian, that was something we would hear from people that like, I don't hear enough people talking about that. Sure. I don't get that a lot. You know, you want to try to achieve that on a bunch of levels, but I think the voice thing has a specific, I don't know.
And there's so much like layered into this, right? I mean, so there's the class thing. One of the things that was fascinating about that conversation was Audie says that people always Google her and get like the big eyes, like, whoa, wait a second. But like, you know, so public radio has this assumption of it being really white. But at least at NPR, I mean, Michelle Norris was the voice of All Things Considered, and then Audie came on after her. And then you have two black women in the host chair. And I think there's sort of this conflation, and we've talked about this a lot, the conflation of This American Life and this like larger public radio landscape with NPR, besides sort of the Delicious Dish parody thing, but the way people sort of think of Serial or This American Life or Planet Money as sort of like these super white places. And NPR is obviously super white. I mean, that's the other element. I mean,
right, no, sure.
I mean, it's like Utah out there. It is.
Like Utah. I just heard that go by.
Utah, you say.
And then there was, I mean, and that conversation came on right on the heels of that fantastic This American Life episode where the middle section was about vocal fry and people concerned trolling about vocal fry, and like, which basically is about gender. And so the idea of like what a neutral voice on the radio sounds like is gendered and it is classed and it is raced and it is messy.
Yeah, it's messy. Coming from a place of privilege and looking at these conversations and seeing people say, I don't hear people who sound like me on the radio, I grew up thinking, I don't want to sound like the people around me. I want to sound like the people on the radio. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it always amazes me that the what we call the mid-Atlantic accent, you know, that mostly women, but some men have in the early part of the century from in films where they talk about going to the theater and all that stuff, that's the finishing school voice that young women of a certain class were taught to affect, put on an affect. But the actual mid-Atlantic accent, I grew up outside of Philly, spitting distance from Baltimore. This is how my friends and family sound, which is, you want to ride our bikes down ashore and get some water ice?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's the mid-Atlantic accent.
That's very good. That's
and,
pretty good.
Well, that's and I made a conscious decision. I remember thinking that on friends and family would say water, but on the electric company, where they should know because it's about how to see and spell words, they say water.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and, you know, this is related, but I would notice that the newscasters on local stations had that flat sort of quote-unquote neutral voice, but everybody they interviewed didn't.
Right.
And I wanted to be part of the first cohort
right,
and not
but,
the second.
Okay, and so this is the other thing that I think is so important, is that there were a bunch of reporters, not just white reporters, but lots of reporters with different racial backgrounds, who made the point during this conversation, there's nothing wrong with learning to make yourself understood, and there's nothing wrong with training your voice. That's part of the thing. The idea is not necessarily for you to talk exactly the way that you popped out of the womb when you're a reporter and you're doing a professional job. The question is, how do you decide what's professional?
Mm-hmm.
That's such a tricky term.
We make assumptions about who NPR is,
right,
which is why people make assumptions about Audie being white or Michelle Norris being white. I'm curious about like whether or not the Browning NPR changes the voices they get on the radio who are not them. And I wonder, this is a challenge that NPR has faced in terms of finding sources for stories, mm-hmm, who are women, who are like economists. I mean, there are so many ways to report a story in which you can end up with a bunch of white dudes as your sources, right? Even if the subject of the story affects people of color or women, you could end up talking to think tank people or a bunch of academics and a bunch of fields in which everything skews. I mean, if you did a story on like the wage gap, you might talk to a bunch of economists,
right,
and you
sure
might end up with a bunch of dudes.
I think the other thing to be conscious of is that in this conversation, I also saw a lot of, again, black reporters in particular and people who have worked in radio who are saying, I did not work on training my voice, like where I was raised,
sure,
and how my parents talk. I don't feel like I'm changing my voice.
Sure.
And people don't necessarily know when they listen to me that I'm a black person. Does that mean there's something wrong with the way that I am talking now?
Right.
And I thought, boy, this is really complicated.
Yeah, Audie was saying that she used to get teased
for everybody,
the way she spoke.
Yeah.
And now it's like she is being rewarded for the way she speaks. And Audie sounds exactly the same on the radio.
Yes.
She said, and
she
like,
does.
I mean, she's snarkier in real life. I mean,
yeah,
she's
funnier, but
she's hilarious.
But her voice is the same.
Right. I mean, she's not like modulating a lot. She's not code switching a lot. So
yeah.
Yeah. There's a documentary called Do I Sound Gay by David Thorpe. This was screened at Toronto. I haven't seen it, but
I have heard of it.
Right. One of the points the film makes is that the last bits of internalized homophobia that gay men hang on to is that they hate how they sound.
Huh.
And I remember as a kid, I never had a real issue with this, but I knew all the kids who did.
Hmm.
And, you know, people would come to me when they were trying to be bullies about gayness or whatever, and they would come to me and go, oh, they there, fellas. And I'd be like, that's imprecise. It's not what it's about. Because if you listen, you know that what the dudes who, quote unquote, have a lisp are not actually lisping with
no
a th. They're not Daffy Duck. What they have is a very sibilant S.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sound that if you were smart, you would key into. But
if you were a smart bully, if you're a smart
bully,
mean,
if you're
jerk,
a smart bully,
right.
But I mean, of course, I still got the gay stuff, not because of how I talked, but because I was bad at sports. So like the roving eye of Sauron finds whatever it finds.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
What the first time I heard myself on NPR, it wasn't about the gay voice. It was about nerd voice.
Huh.
It was about, I heard for the first time my over-articulated R's. And the way that if a word has a terminal consonant, I'm going to hit it really hard. And I think it's because, you know, one reason is because nerds of my ilk are about rules. And we learned these rules about how to say things.
Yeah.
And so it's very important for us to pay obeisance to the way words are meant to be said.
Indeed.
That's the thing that I catch myself on.
Hmm.
It's not the gay voice thing. I don't code switch when I go home to Philly. Or if I hear myself say water, I would hurt myself.
Yeah.
But that is the thing that I have I struggle with.
And here's the thing that's funny is that I worry about this very little. I've become relatively unselfconscious about how I talk. But every now and then I hear myself say it when I say the word story. I hear Philadelphia in there when I say it's a story.
story.
I can hear a little tiny bit of it, and it always makes me a tiny bit self-conscious. And the thing that I wanted to follow up with Tanya.
Oh my gosh, we are all Philadelphians. Come
no,
on.
It, no, no, no. It makes me feel, but there it is, right? It makes me feel regional,
sure.
And I feel like I'm not supposed to sound regional.
Right.
What I wanted to ask Tanya was, you would talk about make my mother proud, right? What is that connected with? Like, that would be the idea that you are supposed to sound how? Like, not just in public radio world, but in your own family. Like, what is that associated with?
You know what it's associated with? Remember how Obama was referred to as clean and articulate?
Uh-huh.
It's
by Joe Biden.
Yeah. It's about that. It's about class and mm-hmm. just
right.
sort of people having preconceived notions about you based on how you sound and present yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you know, if I'm talking to my girlfriends, I might be like, girl, and Cookie was like, girl, and she said, he got four Lucius, but I'm doing it now on this particular podcast, but I wouldn't do that in a piece on
right.
the show.
I guess my point is, like, it's not just external. It's not just public radio coming in and saying, right. this is
well, because
what
my
it sounds
mother's
like to be a
friends will hear
person.
And our family will hear, and it's a reflection on her. I keep saying my mom, but my parents. It's a reflection on my parents in that, you know, they spent a lot of time and energy and money making sure I was educated and going to good schools and having this career. And now you went on the radio and sounded all... What? You know, that. So mm-hmm. there's this other stuff tied into it, yes.
One of the things that was most moving to me about Chenjerai Rise, because I've had this experience so many times, he said he was sort of advocating and evangelizing for This American Life. His friend said that public radio sounds like an old white dude who just had a warm coffee.
Mm-hmm. And then it all sounds like it's taped in the back of a Barnes & Noble, which
right.
is a pretty good line. I'm not going to lie. I don't think it's accurate, but it's pretty
good. But that is actually a barrier to entry for people. I think the Harper High School episode of This American Life is a fantastic
yes.
seminal piece of like reporting. Mm-hmm. I always like shout it out. But my friend's like, I can't sit down and listen to these people talk for an hour. I mean, it's just like, I mean, I think NPR has, and public radio has sort of been dealing with this issue of diversifying its audience for a long time. It is a not insignificant barrier to entry for a lot of people.
If you go and find the piece, he has a couple of clips of himself talking. And you can see what he's talking about when he says, you know, I can sound like this versus I can sound like this. You can see where he feels more authentic in one of them than in the other one.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also see qualities in the one that where he feels less authentic that other people might respond to differently.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a very interesting piece, and I was very glad that that conversation started and that you guys helped push it along.
Thank you. It was a fun, it was one of those conversations. We have conversations about race all the time, and you're like, oh, this is going to be contentious and whatever. And that was actually not contentious. I mean, there were some people popped up like, it's about sounding professional and don't use your hip-hoppy slang, and those people are to be expected and
right.
they're ridiculous or whatever. Most people were sort of like, hey, I love public radio. I listen to public radio all the time. I wish that people sounded like me. And that got complicated by, you know, I mean, I will not name a name, but a very prominent blogger sort of shook his fist at the moon at the way that a lot of Latino reporters at NPR like punch their names, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with Claudio Sanchez, right? And like a lot of people sort of get mad when people say Honduras instead of Honduras
mm-hmm.
or whatever. And like those are things that reporters push back like that. It's like, this is who I am, right? This is like,
right.
I am Claudio Sanchez. I'm
well,
not
that's
Claudio
how you,
Sanchez.
It's the same with Michelle Norris. Like she's allowed to say her name the way her name is.
Absolutely,
you
right.
know?
It's Michelle.
Well, exactly. Exactly. It was very good, I think, and we'll link to a bunch of this stuff, and there's tons of stuff to sift through and pieces to read and
yeah.
and all that business. And the conversation, I would say, the conversation in the comments of some of the pieces that we ran was a little bit less productive,
yeah.
but the discussion on Twitter was very, very good, I thought.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which right. is the weirdest thing. Like, go to Twitter to hear this, like, thoughtful conversation.
Right. No, it was great, though. It was fascinating. I could not look away.
You storified it, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. it was, Transom has a big storify of it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right, great. We will link to a bunch of that stuff. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Tanya Ballard Brown, I would love to hear what is making you happy this week.
Guess what? Music makes me lose control. Okay, so Missy Elliott came
yes.
out on the stage. She, oh my God, it was like hype.
Show.
You know, we all jumped up and started, you know, trying to do, you know, I can't stand the rain and our trash bags. And I was just born yesterday and everything. But there's a whole handful of my peers here in Generation Nebulous, who didn't know who she was. So I was happy to see her, but I was a little bit unhappy about the people who thought that Katy was putting her on.
Yeah, starting out a new musician
like
there.
It wouldn't even be a Katy Perry if it had not been.
Also, that doesn't make sense. Who like has their debut at the Super Bowl? That's not how, that is not how it works.
And now at the Super Bowl halftime show, this new artist
that you've never heard of ever.
Yeah. So, Tanya, being made happy this week by the adventures of Missy Elliott.
Yes, a walk down memory lane.
Fantastic. All right. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. The Wachowski film Jupiter Ascending is coming out this weekend, and I will be there front row center with
Glenn's
a big
excited.
Thing of popcorn, because I predicted with foolish bravado that it'll be a top 10 movie and will make over $200 million. I need the pop culture happy hour of Nation to rise up with me. And make this happen, because it ain't gonna happen otherwise.
Is it getting bad reviews?
Or? It hasn't, but it will. and what else are you gonna see? Like SpongeBob? You're gonna see Seventh Son? Julianne Moore is a witch. Shut up. Go see. That Seventh Son is made for a Sunday afternoon on the couch.
What is Seventh? I don't even know what that is.
Never mind. Jupiter Ascending is for being in the theater, packing it. Okay, the second thing is another film ideally made for a Sunday afternoon on the couch. Lucy, written and directed by Luc Besson, starring Scarlett Johansson, is a dumb movie.
Oh, yes, it is.
It is a dumb, dumb movie. The premise is that Scarlett Johansson gets overdosed with a drug and is able to start using a greater and greater percentage of her brain. That's not the way the brain works. As she does this, she gets more powers. That's also not how the brain works. This movie proves that Morgan Freeman has no shame left. You can see, you want to see something behind his eyes. You see nothing. It dissolves by the end. All sense goes out of this film. It's for those people who thought The Fifth Element was good, but a little too understated.
But you know what? Morgan Freeman has a great radio voice.
He does have a great radio voice. There's a reason to see it. It's dumb, but it's fun. Lucy and Jupiter Ascending this weekend.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
What's making me happy this week is Men in Blazers. The Men in Blazers podcast is a podcast that used to be on the Grantland Network and is now on NBC. It is a podcast done by two amiable British gents who live in the United States now. When I was one of those people who sort of glommed on to European football, or soccer, sorry, after the World Cup, I started watching with much more intentionality. And they are very funny and wry, and it's funny listening to them talk about like peppering American pop culture references into their soccer podcast, because it's weird that they would even understand who like the Fonz was or make a joke about Dukes of Hazzard or whatever. But it is a really smart podcast about soccer, but you don't have to be a soccer fan to listen to it. It's also about pop culture, and they have musicians come by. There's Stuart Murdoch from Belle and Sebastian. He was talking about playing on tour with his bandmates, just pick up league games as they travel. And it's just very fun and silly and smart. And for someone who is a newbie to European soccer, who doesn't get the ins and outs, is learning the ins and outs, it was like a very good starter podcast. So Men in Blazers podcast.
Podcasts and sports.
Yeah.
We like that combination.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Gene Demby. All right, making me happy this week, I got a few things. I got a couple pieces of business that we need to take care of. In March of this year, we are going to be covering on Pop Culture Happy Hour the Nick Hornby book, Funny Girl, which came out as we tape this today. So if you have a chance to read that book, then you will be with us in March when we are reading that book. We're going to read a book. Right? It's pretty exciting. We're going to read that. Again, it's Funny Girl. It's by Nick Hornby. And we'll be covering that in mid-March. Stephen Thompson is not in the room as we speak, but he is not far away. And he and I, as we often do, will be covering the Grammy Awards live on Sunday night. If you are picking this up on Friday, then it'll be in just a couple days. And if you follow us on Twitter or find us on NPR.org, I'm sure that you'll be able to figure out where we are covering the Grammys. Speaking of following us on Twitter, we had a major accomplishment this week and finally got ourselves a proper Twitter feed for the show. It is at NPRPCHH, and lots of people already there joining us. If you have questions, if you have issues, you can tweet at us. I have been kind enough to give other people the password now, so it's not only me tweeting from that account. And then I have two little other things, one of which is that I learned this week that on the 13th of February, I am going to be at the Smithsonian interviewing BJ Novak from The Office. So I will have to hope, as happened when I did a similar event with Shonda Rhimes, that the New York Times does a big controversial piece about BJ Novak on the day that I'm doing this. So crossing my fingers, New York Times, come through for me. And finally, last week we talked about the terrific show Jane the Virgin. And this week, news broke that they have cast Rita Moreno to play Rogelio's mother, which I think is maybe the best news they could have told me about that show, casting-wise. Rita Moreno coming to Jane the Virgin as Rogelio's mother. That's genius and making me very, very happy this week. And of course, we cannot leave the happy segment without pointing out that our tickets for our Oscar omnibus taping went on sale today as we tape this and lasted an entire 3 or 4 minutes. So we will be seeing a lot of you on the 17th of February for our Oscar taping, and we can't wait. We're very excited about that. And that brings us to the end of our show. Again, you can follow us on Twitter at NPRPCHH. You can find all of our handles within those that that account is following. I'm at NPR Monkey C. Tanya is at TWB. Glenn is at GH Weldon. Jean is at GD215. Stephen Thompson, who's not here right at this moment, is at I Dislike Stephen. Jessica Reedy is at Jessica_Reedy. And our pal Mike Katzef is at Mike Katzef. And as I said, in our Twitter feed, NPRPCHH, you'll find all of those folks under those that we follow. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Give the Latino USA podcast from NPR a listen. Latino USA covers current and emerging issues impacting Latinos and other people of color. Reporting on how people live with, struggle with, and celebrate difference, Latino USA chronicles how Latinos are living, shaping, and changing America. Find Latino USA now at iTunes.com/NPR.